and I welcome you to the show. Thank you for joining us here.
My pleasure. Thank you very much, Pete. Good to be with you.
So for those who are completely unfamiliar with the subject, could you just give us a little background about what are chemtrails?
Basically, chemtrails are chemical trails spread by U.S. Air Force tankers, perhaps other aircraft, primarily tanker planes. And these are sunlight-reflecting chemicals, primarily aluminum oxide, in a particulate form, very small. We know from the Hughes patent of 94 that these are 10 micron particles. A hair on your head is 100 microns across, so they're microscopic, spread behind aircraft on the upper atmosphere, 35,000 feet, 37,000 feet, and even higher. And again, the idea, the primary objective is to reflect sunlight. Dr. Teller's pushed hard for this in 98, reflect sunlight and deflect the worst of global warming. There's also a military aspect when barium is included in the mix. This chemical reflects radar and radio waves over the horizon and is used even to fly drones in places like Afghanistan because you get a quicker response than bouncing your drone signal off a satellite.
Wow.
So there's a barium aspect for military, 3D mapping, radar and radio, long distance, and there is the primary objective to moderate climate shift by deflecting sunlight. And there's a third component, very occasionally, I'm told by insiders, maybe one in 100 flights, the military will add a biological warfare simulant to the mix. And the objective there, and it's been the objective since the 50s when this project, biological warfare project, began in the U.S. and Canada and Britain. The idea is to make people sick enough so they report to their doctor or a hospital emergency room, and then that can be tracked. And the dispersal patterns of bioweapons can be, and effectiveness can be ascertained. So there are projects piggybacking on chemtrails.
Mm-hmm. When you talk about the 10 micron size, what size is it that something is classified as a biological weapon where your body can't, your lungs can't filter out particles? Are you familiar with that idea?
I am. The Environmental Protection Agency in the USA calls 10 microns and smaller an extreme human health hazard. And it goes on to say, the agency goes on to say that people can be killed if they're vulnerable, the elderly in particular. Within 24 hours, mortality rates increase. They were looking at air pollution from cars, vehicles, and industry at ground level. But the main point here is it doesn't matter the toxicity of the particle. Aluminum oxide by itself is pretty ubiquitous in the environment. There's a lot of it around. Normally doesn't hurt us, but if you inhale the 10 micron, that can pass right through your lungs into your bloodstream and be attracted to your heart muscles and cause inflammation around the heart and even worse. So the 10 microns is absolutely key here, and again, extreme human health hazard according to the EPA.
Let me move backward again and just for the listeners who aren't familiar, if you're seeing a chemtrail, how would you know if what you're viewing in the sky is a chemtrail?
I do see quite a few photographs on the net showing, quote, chemtrails when they actually look like contrails. So we don't want to be confused here. Personally, if I see a single trail across the sky, I will almost always discount it. I'm looking for multiple trails, either laid in a grid pattern or in parallel rows or a familiar X pattern, knowing at the same time that there's no navigational beacon nearby for aircraft to congregate around. We're used to air traffic patterns around the places where we live, so we notice when something's unusual. So we look up in the sky and we see a white plume, could be a contrail, but instead of dissipating, this plume or plumes is widening, broadening out, and eventually obscuring the sky into a milky, murky overcast. we have a pretty good indication that something unusual is going on. The clincher is if we get to the telephone or go online and we find out the atmospheric conditions for 35,000, 37,000 feet at that time, we look for temperature and humidity. And if the temperature is warmer than minus 70 degrees at altitude, if the moisture content is higher than 70% humidity, less than 70% humidity, we know that contrails can't form. It has to be very cold, minus 70 Fahrenheit, and a lot of moisture, 70% humidity, for normal condensation trails to form. And they form like your breath on a cold winter's day. You exhale, you see the cloud, and then it dissipates. That's what happens when hot engine exhaust with water vapor and particles sublimates in the upper atmosphere, creating this brief, very brief trail. So temperature and humidity are key. The other thing is we often see a broadening, persistent plume at altitude, and in the same, roughly the same airspace at the same time, we might see another aircraft showing no contrail at all or a very short, normal-looking contrail. So if you've got the big, fat, white plume and the normal contrail or no contrail from a nearby aircraft, you know that something's going on. And we know, the scientists tell us, that the only way to make a persistent trail in the sky when it's too warm and too dry to form contrails is to add particles to the fuel mix. So it's a dirtier mix, and you get more particles for water vapor to form around and linger. So those are some of the things. And finally, another giveaway, often we see a prismatic effect. We look up at a contrail, and we don't see anything different. A chemtrail, though, will look like a prism. It will refract sunlight sometimes in a rainbow pattern. Mm-hmm. Looks like maybe an oil sheen in a puddle on the roadway. And this prismatic color indicates chemical presence in that trail.
If you see these going by frequently in the same location, how frequent would it be that it would be not commercial air flights?
Well, it's not really the frequency, but it's the randomness of the traffic pattern. You know, we go out and we hardly notice the airliners and other aircraft going by overhead, but we do have a sense. We do have a sense, and if we want, we can get the schedules from Flight Explorer software and actually identify the aircraft going overhead for that date and time. So what we're looking for is unusual patterns. In other words, we're not used to a lot of air traffic. We might be rural outside of a city, and suddenly we have a major increase of jet trails in the sky and heavy aircraft, big airplanes going overhead. And then it might go on for days or weeks, and then it stops. And then it might start up again. Well, airline schedules don't work that way. Not heavy traffic patterns like that. They're pretty well established. So if air traffic starts and stops over your location and you're not used to that level of air traffic, then you have something else going on. And I would suggest that would be chemtrail military flights.
Mm-hmm. And sometimes with the trails, you can see them dripping in the sky.
That's right. I call it weeping. They actually look like they're weeping. And the good news is, for you, if it's directly overhead, chemtrail fallout cannot come down to you. It will drift, obviously, downwind for some miles because it's very high altitude and the particles are light. Mm. So if it's overhead, it might look freaky, but you're basically okay. Too bad for the people downwind who don't even know what's going on. Mm-hmm. Here on the West Coast, trails are often sprayed just offshore and come ashore on the prevailing wind off the Pacific. And that's tough because you may not even see it happening.
So for people who are skeptical that this is something that's occurring, the one tool you've given us to figure that out is checking the temperature and humidity at the altitude. What other convincing evidence do you have for skeptics that this is occurring?
We have a few things. Of course, in the beginning, people who were concerned about this were told that it's normal flight operations. These are airliners. These are contrails. What's wrong with you? And we're going, well, we understand all that, but we're used to that. And this is something different. It's something so different. People are pulling over the side of the highway, grabbing their families, pointing camcorders at the sky, and we don't do that for regular contrails. So something weird is going on. In the winter of 2000, Mark Stedham down in Houston, Texas, used Flight Explorer software to identify all the airplane, all the heavy aircraft going overhead, commercial or military, and he discovered over a period of 4 months that the commercial contrails lasted 30 seconds or less on average. One lasted 20 minutes, but only one. So basically 30 seconds. NASA and NOAA tell us about 22 seconds for a contrail. At the same time, Stedham recorded trails left by military aircraft, these would be tanker planes, they persisted 4 to 8 hours in the same airspace. So we knew they weren't contrails because we had a side-by-side comparison. On December 8th of that year, 2000, we had a major breakthrough in this investigation when Terry Stewart at the Victoria Airport Authority here in British Columbia returned a call to a friend of mine, a local resident, who wanted to know what was happening with all the intense aerial activity over this capital city and all the X's and grids in the sky. And Stewart called back, left a message on the answering machine, which he came to regret because it was played for quite a lot of people. And he said, well, from what I can tell from my inquiries, it's a military exercise, very odd. So there we had a military exercise officially admitted by an airport official, government official, mm-hmm. not airliners. So that was very big. Mm-hmm. In March of 2001, we had an ABC-affiliated radio reporter, S.T. Brent, and drinking coffee out there in rural Maine, and she starts to see all of these trails in the sky, and they hardly see any commercial planes. So she got her partner, Lou. They went out and they counted 30 jets weaving persistent plumes over their home. She called her assistant news director, Richard Dean, at WMWV, and he took the entire news staff out. And hold on for this one. They counted 370 lines in the sky. So wow. They were convinced something weird was going on. She started calling around to air traffic controllers and finally got a senior manager for the northeastern United States on the line, and he said, well, I'll check it out. He said, right, you should be seeing one airliner at your location. I got 30 of them. Finally, over three taped interviews, two in front of witnesses, our source, who we called Deep Sky to protect his family and his job, he confirmed that these were U.S. Air Force tanker planes conducting what he'd been told was climate modification operations over the U.S., and he said, yeah, we could see them on radar flying up into Canada. And because the particles they were emitting were visible on radar screens, the controllers were being told to bring in commercial flights below these tankers so that they wouldn't be lost in the radar clutter. Mm. So now we have an FAA official admitting that this program is going on and going into some detail. And some of those taped interviews are in my book. You mentioned Chemtrails Confirmed. 2010, that's the most recent update. I've got about six versions of this. It's available online. WillThomasOnline.net is an ebook, and if you get the ebook rather than the soft cover, you can actually hear these interviews and look at some videotape and many photographs. So we're pretty sure now we've got an FAA official, we've got Terry Stewart's work, word, we have Mark Stedham's work in Houston. So at that point, we know what's going on. Also, the Hughes patent, filed in, as I mentioned, 1994 by the Hughes Aircraft Company for the stratospheric seeding of these materials for the reduction of global warming, called for 10 micron aluminum oxide particles to be sprayed into the stratosphere, but it cautioned that the visual whitening of the skies might be unpopular. And in fact, it appears that it's very unpopular now. But those are some of the things. We also have laboratory tests that concur with the Hughes patent, confirm this. One in Espanola, Ontario, summer of 98, people wondering what's going on in the air above their head. Their children are getting sick. They have short-term memory loss. They ask the provincial government to investigate. They finally get the Ministry of Environment down there to do air sample studies. And in August, it made the CBC National Television because there was a near riot in the town hall when the government ministry refused to release the air sample tests. So a citizen there collected some samples of the fallout rain falling through the chemtrails and had them independently tested and found very high levels of aluminum oxide as well as quartz particulates in this fallout. And later on...
As in quartz crystals?
Quartz crystals, that's right. Conductive quartz crystals. And finally in... Whoa, where are we? 2002 in Alberta, in Edmonton, Dave Dickey, who ran a landscaping company there, noticed the plants dying and did some surveying and discovered that electrical conductivity in the soil in Edmonton, that's November 2002, was at 4.6 to 7, and the normal for Alberta is 1. So very highly conductive, and he thought maybe it has something to do with those airplanes overhead. He took samples as well of snow falling through these trails, and Norwest Labs said the aluminum content in the sample was high and unusual. So he went to air traffic control with some kids, some boys, on Father's Day in 2002, and they watched what the controllers called Petro 011 and Petro 012. They said these are U.S. tankers flying down from Alaska, and you can watch them circling Edmonton and leaving trails that we can see on our scopes. We can put the cursor on them and track these trails. They went for miles behind these tanker planes. In the meantime, they had a Japan Airlines flight coming in on the radar scope showing no trail at all. So they all went outside, and the controllers and Dickey located the two tankers because of that signature white plume they were dragging. Mm-hmm. And they also found the JAL airliner, similar flight level, no contrail at all. And the radar guy said, well, yeah, we see these guys up there a lot. So now we have radar confirmation and visual confirmation at the same time.
And you said that those tanker planes came from Alaska?
That's right. Yeah, they fly up and down the coast here. So they came out of Alaska, circle Alberta, and then fly down into the States. They might fly 2,000-3,000 miles in a mission.
And are there sightings of these in other countries?
Well, we're all over the Northern Hemisphere. Many in the UK, France, Germany, all reporting in. Australia, some reports out of New Zealand I'm not sure about, but we do have reports. I haven't seen anything confirmed Mexico way, South America, that way, although we get scattered reports, the people looking into this subject. Also out of Japan and South Korea, I got some very interesting videotape from South Korea. So I would say definitely all the United States, all parts of Canada, most of Europe, including the former Soviet Union, reporting chemtrails. So fairly extensive program, but as I said, primarily U.S. Air Force tankers because they have the biggest tanker fleet. They have over 400 of these airplanes.
Now, this is happening over land for sure. Do we know if it's if they're spraying over the ocean?
Well, we don't know. I mean, you can look at satellite photographs, and many people do, and you see these crisscross lines, and people say, look, they're spraying chemtrails over the ocean. Well, that's where your major air traffic routes converge as well, and in fact, it could be persistent contrails and water vapor just because of the extreme amount of traffic there.
Uh-huh.
We can say that chemtrails are being spread off the coast because we can see them being spread off the coast, but I don't know if they're being done over the open ocean. What you get when you do it over cities and over rural areas is you block ultraviolet radiation. We've measured that with simple meters, and under the chemtrails as well as an overcast sky, you get a much reduced level of UV, so you can protect crops and you can protect people from getting cataracts and skin cancer if you spray it over populated areas. You'll also make people very ill indeed, so it's not a good trade-off.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing people comment on is that these are often sprayed at night or just before daybreak, so that you don't see it being done, and yet when you wake up and you turn on the TV or radio and it says, oh, blue skies today, and you look out and it's totally overcast, that's why.
Mm-hmm. Now, has there been any Freedom of Information requests regarding chemtrails that you're aware of?
I think in the early days there were. They did not get it very far. I've never seen any admission from government or military that this is going on officially in writing. We have, again, the FAA people telling us definitely it's going on. But I haven't seen an FOI come back with any kind of documentation.
Many years ago, there was a claim that Representative Kucinich had written the Space Preservation Act, which would ban chemtrails. Any validity to that story?
Well, there's lots of validity to that. He's a very, as you know, high-profile representative in the U.S. Congress. He ran for presidency, and in October, as you say, 2001, he put forward House Resolution 2977, caused quite a stir because Section 7 said they wanted to ban chemtrails, and he used the word, and he was hammered for that, and people asked him, why in the world would you introduce a bill banning something the U.S. Air Force calls a hoax? And his answer was, I'm the head of the Armed Forces Oversight Committee, and I know what's going on in the military, and there's an entire program in the Department of Defense. That's a good slip, isn't it? Department of Defense. Vision for 2020, that's developing these weapons. That was his answer, and of course, under intense political pressure, H.R. 2977 was replaced by H.R. 3616, which no longer, surprise, referred to chemtrails. But when he ran for the presidency in 2004, Kucinich was in Santa Cruz, California at a public meeting, and people there, somebody got up and said, are chemtrails real? And he replied, yes. So I will go with Representative Kucinich on that.
And then in the later legislation, the language was changed to reflect exotic weaponry.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right. Yeah, no more chemtrails mentioned.
Just wanted to clarify that. So maybe they just think that chemtrails fall under the category or under the description of exotic weaponry.
I think that the people who rewrote the bill didn't want any mention of it at all, and didn't want to see that word in a law in the United States. Not good when you're trying to deny these things exist. And that was, what do we say, 02, November 2002. 3 years later, in September 05, we had another breakthrough. A friend of mine, Bob Fedrakis, award-winning reporter for Columbus Alive, in Ohio, was interviewing two Lawrence Livermore scientists on loan to the Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Ohio. Wright-Patterson, of course, home of the Tesla patents, home of the HAARP project up in Alaska. And they said, oh yeah, we're working on this project, and one of them is to spray sunlight reflecting aluminum oxide to slow global warming. The second is to spread barium to bounce radar and radio beams over the horizon for military applications.
Mm-hmm.
So they admitted it, and they said, you know, we're very concerned, and so were the controllers, by the way, that people could be getting very ill from these, from all the fallout, but that's what we're working on.
Mm-hmm. Now, you haven't mentioned yet the VTRPE.
No, that's really part of what they were saying. That's a, you know, a very technical name, technical aspect for this 3D mapping, and the U.S. Navy was involved at this, and the Air Force, and that's exactly what it was and is. I mean, this is a program that's going on today.
Uh-huh.
So radar, 3D radar imaging using barium in the sky as a temporary antenna to X-ray the Earth, if you like.
And what about the RF ducting?
Well, same thing. Radio frequency ducting. You can think of it as conducting these beams over the horizon. If you just shoot them off, of course, from an antenna, the curvature of the Earth will make sure that they go a certain distance and then out into space. So you want to bounce your radar and radio off some kind of an antenna, and the chemtrails act as a temporary aerial antenna, and you can send, say, HARP energy all over the world with chemtrails by bouncing it off this, off these chemicals. So you can conduct energy, not just radar and radio, but energy over the horizon quite long distances and mess with other countries' weather, power grids, communications, things like that.
Are there any other locations that the tankers are primarily flying out of besides Alaska?
It looks like there may be bases in California, Louisiana, throughout the states, and they may not be, in some cases they are airports that have been closed and now reopened. But remember, these are Air Force tankers, so if you're driving by and have a look, you'll basically see what look like tanker airplanes, and you wouldn't be able to tell if they were refueling military aircraft or spreading chemtrails. So the people doing this can be fairly open in where they fly out of, because these tankers are in the air all the time.
Mm-hmm.
But basically, to answer your question, air bases across the United States, we don't think they're landing here and refueling in Canada. They've got the range to just overfly Canada.
Mm-hmm. So if this is preserving the Earth from becoming overheated through global warming or something like that, why would they need the secrecy in this exercise?
First of all, the governments allowing this do not want to admit the full gravity of this planetary emergency. We are in dire straits here, and we are in a very serious situation in terms of climate shift, and we're nearing a runaway scenario. We've got the warmest decade on record, the warmest 12 months, the warmest 6 months, the warmest April, May, and June this year ever on record, and those records being broken around the world, the ice sheets melting, you know the list as well as I do. So pretty grave emergency if you have to start spreading chemicals in the sky since 1997, 98, to the present time. And so governments are loath to admit anything, including that. Another problem is, although most people, I think, would say, good, I can keep driving my SUV, pollution, you know, petroleum pollution and profits as usual, great, you know, keep spraying it. Other people might question the fallout, both the particulate fallout, very dangerous, and the climate fallout. This is not a good thing. For one thing, if we think we have some kind of technical fix, and it does not appear to be working that well, by the way, then continuing to spread carbon in the air is going to kill our oceans off. And since the planet's, you know, 70% ocean, this is probably a really bad idea to turn the oceans into acid lakes. And that's what the carbon is doing right outside my door as we speak. So spreading chemtrails and continuing to kill off the oceans, bad idea. Another major issue I have with the chemtrails is, let's say they're working somewhat. We know that the Earth does respond and the atmosphere responds to what the scientists call forcing. And after 9/11, you recall, when the airliners were grounded for those several days, atmospheric scientists were excited because they got to measure skies without polluted by contrails, as far as they knew. And they found that the temperature bounced up 1 degree centigrade in 3 days, which was gigantic. And they said, wow, the atmosphere is really sensitive to these contrails that obscure the sun and cause a climate change. And that they were right about the contrails. Chemtrails even more so, because it's concentrated. So let's say the chemtrails are cooling the planet slightly, even as we overheat like crazy. What happens if you stop the chemtrails? If peak oil really starts to bite, and it will over the next few years, what happens if budget crunches really start to bite, and they are now? What happens if you can't keep up this level of aerial sunscreen, as Teller called it, and you curtail or cut back the program? Suddenly you're going to have a major jump in global warming if you remove this screen. And scientists are already worried that as we cut particulate pollution levels in cities around the world, we're going to really ramp up global warming as an unintended consequence of this.
Because the particulates are reflecting sunlight.
That's right. They're scattering sunlight. They're called scatterers. And if you remove it, then you get more intensive heating of the atmosphere. So we want to get out of the chemtrail business right away, and we don't want to keep this program going as a mask for the true extent of global warming, atmospheric warming.
Now, when you said that there was a 1 degree increase on the days that those flights weren't there, how do they tell the difference between, some days are warmer than others? How is it calculated that difference?
Right. Well, they would take a long baseline. We're talking Patrick Minnis and NASA did some of these studies. He wasn't alone. There were others. And you take a long baseline and you go, what's different? And when you get a shift that big, it really stands out. I mean, it really stands out. It wasn't anything they had seen before. So certainly temperatures can vary a degree, but over their baseline, they went, it made all the scientific papers. They went, wow, this is incredible. So there's been, interestingly enough, quite a bit of research about the effect of jet airline traffic, and I won't fly in airliners anymore. I love to fly, but they're doing so much damage to the upper atmosphere in terms of ozone depletion, in terms of global warming, that these airliners have got to be brought down to the ground, or at least lower altitudes. Very serious. But there's a lot of interest in the effect on the atmosphere from airliners, and particularly contrails. The military is trying to eliminate them, of course, because they draw a big arrow to their airplanes, and that's why tankers were told by one general, never fly at high enough altitudes to drag a contrail. It takes the airplanes that are refueling more fuel to get up to them, for one thing, but basically they don't want to be targets. So if you see tanker planes drawing massive trails across the sky, that's not normal military practice.
Mm-hmm. So what is the difference between the normal military practice and the application of the chemtrails?
Well, the military wants to fly the tankers at lower altitudes, and the chemtrails are spread at much higher altitudes.
Oh, I see.
And so that's very different. Now, they actually have a paper called Owning the Weather by 2050, and the Air Force, in this paper, available online, that's also in my download, talk about weather force specialists, as they term them, flying tankers and emitting these trails as an aerial screen. And so the Air Force has been into this for a long time. They've been in the weather modification since the Second World War, when they tried to burn fog off runways so they could keep flying on foggy days. And of course, Vietnam, Operation Popeye, they tried to rain out with heavy monsoons the supply trail from Hanoi into South Vietnam, and that was a major application of weather modification techniques, and that was leaked in the U.S. press and ended up in a congressional committee that, and then finally the U.N. with the ENMOD Treaty sought to ban geoengineering activity. And of course this year we've seen, or late last year, in Nagoya, Japan, in October 2010, they passed a formal recommendation there. These are the UN countries, for a moratorium on all climate engineering activities. So there's quite a lot of interest now in starting and stopping geoengineering, depending on what side of the fence you're on.
Mm-hmm.
It's gone. It's gone public, and they even have a nice term for it now. We don't talk about chemtrails. We talk about solar radiation management. Okay.
Mm.
So we're going to manage something that we have very little understanding of, and makes me nervous.
I'd agree. Is there other chemicals that have been identified that are in the mix?
I see a lot of reports online, but I haven't seen the lab tests to back them up.
Mm-hmm.
Some people think there's a link to Morgellons disease. Certainly there are some very weird fibers literally attached to chemtrails when we've seen some very strange things through microscopes. What all that means, I don't think that any of the chemtrail researchers I've been following are qualified to know that.
Mm-hmm.
But there are allegations of all kinds of things in chemtrails. But we can say definitely, I've got two lab tests here, independent, years apart, we can say aluminum oxide and barium for sure. I don't know if the quartz particulates are still being used. And, as I said, biological warfare simulants and anything else, I haven't seen the lab test to back that up.
And is there any specifics on what the biological contaminants would be?
No, but I think we can look back to the adjuvants and simulants spread in the 50s and 60s and serratia marcellans, I'm trying to get my brain in gear here, but that is researchable in the past, but I don't have a reading on specific bugs, if you will, now. Interestingly, at the Espanola, at the lab there that did the Espanola lab test, they said we found an awful lot of bacteria and viruses and fungi in this sample without identifying any closer than that. When I read that the meteorological people in the United States in the 1980s were discovering very weird, mutated, and very large clusters of viruses, fungi, bacteria on their weather balloons when they would bring them down from high altitudes. Then I went on to research and learned that these bugs live and breed in the upper atmosphere. They have a lot to do with rain and our weather.
Wow.
And they just sit up there and mind their own business, and if they ever fall out of the sky, they mostly fall into the ocean, so we're not bothered by them. So I thought, my goodness, what if chemtrails are bringing these creatures down to Earth? What if they're piggybacking on the aluminum particles in particular, because they seem to like aluminum,
mm-hmm.
and what if they're falling down into our lungs? Our bodies would have no defense, would never recognize these invaders, and we could become very ill indeed. I was stunned when the two Lawrence Livermore scientists interviewed by Bob Petrakis there at Wright-Patterson independently and without prompting expressed their concern that these chemicals that they were involved with spraying in the sky were bringing down to Earth the bacteria and viruses and fungi living in the upper atmosphere. So they had the same worry, and I think it's pretty certain, I'm definitely certain that this stuff's being brought down. And now, guess what? We can add the Fukushima radioactive fallout to this equation, because certainly that will be precipitated out of the sky, however much is remaining, with chemtrails. So it's going to bring down things that are very harmful and were not intended in the original idea behind this. You know, people say, well, it's a big call, they're trying to kill the population, and well, you don't spray it over everybody. You target people if you're trying to do that, and you probably use vaccines, but no, the people getting sick is an unintended consequence. Now, if you continue to do that for years, knowing that children and elderly in particular are going to get sick and even die, and continue to do it, then at that point, yes, it becomes deliberate, and it's just more collateral damage, as we've seen in Afghanistan and Iraq and
mm-hmm.
all over.
We only have about 10 minutes left. I'm going to open up the phone to callers. If anyone
Good.
Has a question you'd like to reach us here in the station, the phone number is area code 315-859-4200. That's 315-859-4200. What would be the effect of runaway climate change? So let's say that all of our efforts here fail at some point. What do things look like then?
Well, the first thing we're looking at, and we're there already, major shifts in rainfall patterns and serious drought followed by serious flooding. So So I'm very concerned about that. One thing that air pollution does, including chemtrails, is they mess up the convection currents, scientists are now discovering, and wind patterns near the surface diminish. They diminish enough to affect rainfall patterns in places like California, which urgently needs it, in places like India and the subcontinent, which absolutely depend on their monsoons, and the monsoon almost didn't show last year over there, so it's very late. So the convection disturbances by particulate pollution, particularly chemtrails, very serious. You're talking, scientists are saying 2 billion, that's with a B, 2 billion people could die from starvation when these droughts really, really get cranked up. So that's what we're looking at. You know, it sounds kind of nice if you're living in northern Canada or up here in Canada. Gee, you know, it gets a little warmer and that's pretty nice, but in some places we'll benefit, no question, but most won't. And in fact, the food disruption we have seen in recent years and we're already seeing this year is very, very worrisome. As I mentioned, the death of the ocean is has been linked to 90% plus species die-off on this planet. So if we really manage to kill off the ocean, and we're well on our way, that could be just about certainly the end of society and civilization as we know it. Those are some of the things we're looking at. And right now, of course, the wild and extreme weather events, again, are already having major impacts on crops and on national budgets. Of course, every government on the planet's bankrupt right now, but they certainly cannot afford continuous Katrinas, for example.
And what is the cause of the ocean die-offs?
The ocean die-off is the acidification of the ocean, because the carbon falling into the ocean becomes a carbonated product. Think of vinegar, and it raises the acid balance of the ocean. Now, that's pretty hard to do, because this is a lot of water, as you can appreciate. So when that happens, the inertia is forever. It's for, you know, decades or hundreds of years. And if we warm the ocean, and we're warming it as well at the same time, here on the coast, the fishers are showing me their charts the government produces every year showing the warming waters, and they said the fish are leaving, the migration patterns are changing already. So it has real ramifications here, the oceans have virtually died in the past. We see spreading dead zones of water without oxygen, big dead zones from European waters to right off here off the Washington seaboard, and again around the world. So I'm an ocean sailor, and I've sailed all over the Pacific, and I'm really, really concerned about the ocean aspects, because for most people it's out of sight, out of mind. Even people on the coast tend to look inland and really don't look out toward that big, big body of water out there. And you don't want to change that, because those changes will remain for quite a long time.
What can people do about the chemtrail situation?
Well, you can go online. I do have some links up that of websites that I check and appreciate. And through those websites, you can find links to organizations. Many states have Skywatch programs. I was involved in the Skywatch program down in New Mexico. And so you can link and network with other groups. But frankly, it's very hard to get any action on this side of the Atlantic Ocean in Europe. You start linking with the Europeans, they're on it. They are really on it. If you want action in terms of chemtrails and government response to chemtrails, then Greece and Belgium, where they just had a major conference, the Belfort Conference in 2010, International Symposium. You have ministers, Flemish environment minister, admitting off the record that the chemtrails over Belgium are geoengineering, solar radiation management. So you have quite a bit of activity and concern in the European Union. That's the good news. The less good news is it's very hard to get any kind of action here in North America. There was a gentleman in California attempting a lawsuit, class action lawsuit last year, but I haven't been able to update that or track it, so I don't think that went forward. But citizen action and just keep at it, because the, as I mentioned, geoengineering is out of the closet now. You know, the very first press conference that Obama's scientific advisor, Mr. Holdren, held, the very first conference, he said, you know, this climate change is so serious, we might have to take technical measures here to deal with it. And he was referring to chemtrails and other geoengineering aspects. So they're saying that we want to do this when in fact it's being done, but they're floating this before the public in the United States and Europe, and if people are paying attention, they don't seem to grasp the implications of this.
And so because we know so little about how all of this works, we could potentially cause the climate situation to magnify rather than to alleviate it using this technology, possibly?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Scientists, for example, are still arguing whether cloud cover traps heat underneath it or reflects sunlight above it. Mm. So, you know, what, you know, they're still trying to figure that one out, and there's debate on both sides. So in other words, we don't really know what we're doing. We're poking sticks at a very dynamical system, and you can start a chain of unpredictable events, chaos theory tells us, and end up in a very simplified environment or simplified atmosphere. And you don't want that. You want a resilient, complex environment and atmosphere that can respond to changes. So, you know, very dangerous to start fooling around. And these chemtrails absorb moisture in the sky, as you can appreciate, and that can cause or make drought much worse if you start drying out the air with these chemicals. And, of course, they're using chemtrails, different types of chemtrails, and HAARP to attempt to steer hurricanes. And, yeah, that's really wonderful, but oops, the Katrina missed Texas, but they steered it into Louisiana. Oh, sorry about that. So when you change storm patterns, you're fooling with heat energy, massive heat energy, and you might deflect it somewhere or even turn it off, but that heat goes somewhere else. So if you stop the rain over your city, you might cause floods over your neighbors. If you block the hurricane in the Caribbean, you could have that heat would go somewhere else and do damage halfway around the world. So it's not something you want to play with in the ways that governments are able to do with their very sophisticated HAARP transmitters and now chemtrails.
Any information about Project Cloverleaf?
That's on the net. People in the airlines have been coming forward for years saying, yeah, we're aware of this, and Project Cloverleaf is the name it goes by. And under Cloverleaf, these particulates, chemtrail particulates, are being added to the fuel in some airliners and spread at altitude when they, you know, fly their regular routes. So the Hughes patent said, you know, if you want to spread these chemicals over the sky in a wide enough area to do any good in terms of reflecting sunlight, use airliners. So, and we have photographs that look like chemtrails coming behind jetliners. Could be contrails, but they certainly look like chemtrails. So Cloverleaf would be the civilian aspect. I have trouble with that because I don't know of an airline pilot. Certainly not all airline pilots would go along with this. Once they were told they were throwing, you know,